I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, this is Emma, Senior Account Manager at the Webby Awards. The 24th Annual Webby Awards is open for entries. We have all new categories this year for your work in podcasts, social, immersive and mixed reality video, and much more. Check out all the categories and enter by the early entry deadline on Friday, October 25th, to take advantage of the best pricing. Enter your work at webbyawards.com.
From the Webby Awards, I'm David Michelle Davies. This is the Webby Podcast.
Great stories make people change.
Don't fear tackling real shit.
Keep speaking out. It matters.
Justice is worth fighting for.
Hey there, and welcome back to the Webby Podcast. The ACLU has been more visible in recent years, which is a great thing. Whether it's fighting the U.S. government's Muslim ban or working to end the suffering of young immigrants at our borders, the ACLU has played a big role in the defense of American civil liberties and been a champion for their mission in digital media across the United States. Our next guest is working behind the scenes to protect us in this modern world. As Surveillance and Cybersecurity Counsel at the ACLU, Jennifer Granick works on government surveillance, speech, and privacy. At the core of what she does is fight against the intrusion of technology, surveillance, and search when it infringes on our basic civil liberties. This covers everything from if the Ring doorbell cameras should be accessible to police investigators, to whether immigration officials should be able to access social media accounts. We touched on a lot of big ideas, from the communities who are at higher risk of being surveilled by the government and what they can do about it, to what drives the abuse of our civil liberties in the first place. We started by talking about her work trying to make the process of obtaining search warrants more rigorous.
One of the biggest issues in government surveillance that we deal with is trying to protect our private data with a warrant requirement under the Fourth Amendment.
Right.
It's super important. But if warrants are kind of anemic, then it doesn't really actually accomplish the task, which is to prevent government abuses. So this part of the project is, you know, how do we reinvigorate the warrant requirement to make it actually mean something and not just be like a rubber stamp by right. judges?
And part of this is because there's just so many new places where law enforcement officials can get information that are just like have never been defined or regulated or written about. Or is that sort of kind of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, phones, obviously, yeah. Social media, you know, we're just generating data as we move through the world. And, you know, it used to, you could kind of say, well, it's just with my online activities, but increasingly with your phones or the Internet of Things or, you know, smart cities, cars with their black boxes generating data, it's kind of everywhere now. And there are pieces of information we're just like littering the world with. And the question is, will privacy protections meet the challenge of this new era where we're just generating personal data all the time?
What's the biggest challenge there? Is it trying to go around and figure out all the specific places where all this data is being generated and then write specific rules for how the government can collect data from them and what kind of warrants? Or is it sort of broader, like to give some sort of like higher level guideline as yeah. to like what could be collected or changing that higher level guideline?
What does privacy like even yeah. mean yeah. anymore?
Yeah. Because it seems like it would be hard to, I mean, every single day there's a new device of something that right. nobody's ever thought of.
Yeah. I mean, those things sort of all go together. You
right.
know, it's like, what do we think is worthy of protection? What are we worried about? Why are we concerned about our information being collected? What are the things that are actually being done, you know, sort of from the generation to the intake to the storage to the sharing and use of information? It's like all those pieces going together that we worry about.
Why should we be concerned about the data being collected, and what should we be concerned about?
Yeah, you know, I think some people are more concerned about private or commercial collection of data, and some people are more concerned about government surveillance. For me, on the private side, I personally like to have ads that are relevant to my interests, but I think the problems there are, you know, the aggregation of data from multiple different places where we shop or, you know, our medical records or whatever, and how those things can be amalgamated into basically a dossier about us, which can be used in all kinds of ways. And then I think second on the commercial side is the manipulation of our data in order to kind of present us with discriminatory ads. We're not seeing the same things that our friends are seeing. Mm. And to kind of fracture our online reality in that way, which can be very coercive and and discriminatory and that kind of thing. For me, being at the ACLU, I'm more concerned with government surveillance. That's my work. And government conducts surveillance with technology, you know, from obtaining the information from commercial entities, and then also just generally with, you know, license plate readers or cell phone location devices or drones and cameras and all of that stuff. So there's a whole another non-commercial way that law enforcement is basically taking advantage.
Yeah,
spying on us with this new technology. And you know, what are the rules for that new technology? We are seeing those rules start to evolve and change, which is awesome. But as your question suggested, there are so many new sources of information. You know, just even knowing what they are and identifying them can really be a challenge.
A lot of places to go and ask to delve in further there. Let's start with, what are like the really terrible ways government is abused recently? I think there's obviously a litany in history of government abuse of people's information. But recently, what are the ways that officials or government officials have collected information and really abused it?
I think everybody's paying attention knows that immigration is a huge issue right now, you know, enforcement of immigration rules. And what we're seeing is that surveillance technologies are being used to target particular communities that are, you know, the ICE and CBP, the Customs and Border Control, are focusing on to target with deportations and that sort of thing. So from, you know, keeping track of people's families, their license plate detection, you know, going to employers and collecting information there. I mean, what we're doing is we're seeing these modern tools of data aggregation and collection being turned against these communities of people, usually Latino, who are suspected to have friends and relatives who are, you know, not documented. So, you know, that's just one example. And I think, you know, we're also seeing use of these tools against certain social movements. So there's been a lot of reports about surveillance of Black Lives Matter and other kind of advocacy movements that are trying to, you know, change the way we do things, but a message that the government doesn't necessarily like. Federal government created this category of people to be worried about called Black identity extremists. It's not really a thing, but it sort of creates this idea that there's something to be worried about by people who are, you know, basically raising issues for communities of color. So, you know, those are real problems too in terms of, you know, it's the vulnerable among us who are the ones who are targeted first.
You brought up immigration. Read there's so many stories about so many weird things happening at like airports and in customs and so forth. At least like this general idea that people are coming in and they're having their phones checked. The custom agents are logging into their social media and seeing who their friends are. That's like an ongoing real thing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the agents are looking at people's social media or demanding that people give passwords as they try to enter the country. They're asking them questions. They're, you know, basically using the border search process to get into people's private information without a warrant or even needing to show any cause. So, you know, it's an opportunity to collect this information. And we don't really know what agents are doing. You know, for a lot of people, they come in, you know, with cell phones, and the agent will say, you need to show me your cell phone in order to enter the country. And the agent will take it away. And then maybe later bring it back.
Right.
What's happened? Where's the data? Is it, you know, do they look at it and, you know, do they keep it forever in a database? What happens to this information? So it's quite scary because it used to be expensive to keep and analyze and understand data. And now it's just infinitesimally cheap.
Mm.
Once you build the infrastructure, the rest of it is pretty easy. And that's one of the reasons why we really worry about, you know, the infrastructure for collecting and storing and processing data as like another part of it, not just the collection, but what technologies we build that may be used in this context now, but are susceptible to abuse and mission creep over time.
It's hard to wrap your head around, and maybe you have some insight into this, and that's surprising as somebody sort of on the outside of all these issues, is, you know, you expect that humans would stop some of this nefarious stuff, that like the people who work in these agencies, I don't think by and large behaved this way previously. Maybe they did, and I'm just naive. And suddenly there's like a new administration, and now it's like this, it feels like, if you read the news, like sort of like a rampant abuse of all of these things. And like, how did all of these people suddenly go from, you know, acting one way to acting another? And it's obviously more nuanced than that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good question. And I have the same perception from reading the news. I certainly don't want to make any excuses for, you know, culture comes from the top.
Sure.
You know, organizational culture comes from the top. I mean, I was a criminal defense attorney for many years, so I tend to see bad behavior as the function of a system as opposed to, you know, individual moral failing, although certainly we have more than enough of that in this world. And I think that, you know, when you have an organization where you're praised for, let's say, arresting people, or you're praised for convictions, or you're praised for detentions, or, you know, and that's really your incentive structure, even well-intentioned person can have their behavior kind of like, you know,
altered,
moved. Oh, yeah, altered over time.
I need to find this many people coming in illegally or arrest this many people. Those numbers are higher than they used to be. These tools are now available to me. They weren't before.
Yeah. Everybody else is doing a better job, or, you know, they're like, you get the attaboys or whatever. And just like, you know, over time, I think it can structure people or like incentivize or mold or encourage people into doing stuff that, you know, 3 years later, if they looked back, they're like, I can't believe this is my job, or, you know, what am I actually doing?
Right.
But like I said, I do think a lot of the culture and incentives and all that are set at the top. And, you know, from the Department of Education to the Environmental Protection Agency, the people at the top have very different priorities in the past few years.
Yeah. So other than changing that, you know, which is a thing into itself, which we could talk about
2020,
another time.
I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What are like sort of the key things that, whether it's this administration or some other administration in the future that isn't, you know, friendly to civil liberties, what are the types of things the ACLU is trying to do now in the sort of like the bigger things to make it more difficult for these things to happen? You know, it's...
Yeah. I mean, we work on...
Well, specifically around immigration, since we were talking about
I mean, you know, we have Immigration Rights Project, and those lawyers have been doing this just heroic work fighting the border wall and the family separation policy, just going to court, you know, the Muslim ban, just going to court again and again and fighting these unbelievably inhumane policy implementations. And also working with people in the local communities and the surveillance lawyers looking at how tech tools for keeping track of people are being abused in that context. We have a racial justice project. We have women's rights. We have my project, which is speech privacy and technology. And one of the great things about the ACLU is we have so many different projects that are, you know, sort of working together and focused on civil liberties and, you know, all these areas.
And so tell me about your project, speech privacy and technology.
Yeah, so it's an interesting project because it's really looking at the way that things are changing, you know, because of technology, and also, you know, putting two issues that most of the time work well together, but sometimes are at odds, speech and privacy, in the same bucket.
Hmm.
And privacy enables speech because if people can say what they want to say without fear of reprisals, it enables a more robust public debate. But it's also true that sometimes privacy and speech are at odds. I was just talking to somebody today about the Ring cameras, you know, that local police departments and Amazon have been working to kind of push out to different neighborhoods. And there's a camera on it and it records, you know, often not just what's on somebody's front porch, but in the street as well. And they're a real privacy invasion for a number of reasons. But, you know, it is a First Amendment right to video record stuff that happens in the public street. And this is individuals who are doing it. Like, how do you deal with, you know, those sorts of conflicts?
So. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really interesting area because, I mean, the thing I think hasn't happened yet, but who knows now, maybe it has and I haven't caught on to it, is that those things haven't actually been networked together in a way that, like, regular people can access them. But you could – have they? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's one of the things about Ring that's kind of interesting, is that it's a distributed surveillance network but capable of consolidating, because neighbors can upload videos that their cameras take to a centralized repository where other neighbors can see it, but also police departments can see it as well. So, you know, I think – everybody would be a lot less frightened about it if there were like 15 different solutions and everybody had a video that they just stored in their own house just in case they got burglarized, they could share it with the police department. But the idea that everybody has the same thing and it's all going up to a server where all those neighbors can see it and the police department can see it, and I don't know, but presumably Amazon can see it too. That's really, it's that consolidation that scares us. And this is the thing we see in, you know, digital privacy issues all the time, which is that the collection and storage and analysis is so much cheaper now than it used to be.
Right.
Yes, you could have had a police officer, you know, on every street, or neighbors could have been looking out their window, but with technology, it's like trivial to do that.
And at some point you'd imagine that like somebody will come up with something where like you could share your live Ring feed on something and like have it geolocated, and then like somebody could pay something to be able to go and look at everybody's Ring feed in real time. And then you'd have like, I mean, in some parts of New York,
facial recognition on that or whatever. Yeah.
In some parts of New York, it just sort of means you could kind of be looking at everything anytime you wanted.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are probably some cameras that, you know, are available over the internet where people can log in and look. But, you know, this is something where you're really covering a whole neighborhood. I went and did some Get Out the Vote work a couple of weeks ago, and every house in this particular neighborhood had one of these Amazon products.
Right. That's a great example because you're not just like going to your friend's house and ringing the doorbell. You're going around and you're advocating for a political candidate. And now we find out the administration is blocking aid to try and, you know, dig up dirt on an opposition. And you start to think that like, how can these things be used against me if I'm in the wrong place?
I mean, I'm pretty privileged, so I don't worry too much about myself. And I think that's one of the reasons why I have the luxury, you know, of being out there without putting myself or my family at a lot of risk. There are a lot of other activists out there who don't have that, you know, peace of mind. But it is true that, you know, that local police department in El Dorado County, you know, can look at those feeds if they're uploaded and be like, this person has been to 18 houses, and maybe they'll be able to guess what I'm up to.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there like a standard that the rest of the world follows with some of these things that we are different than?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll just compare to Europe. And Europe has a very different approach to privacy than we do. So in the United States, we call our approach to privacy sectoral, meaning that there are categories of information. We pass laws about those particular categories. So health records or education records or credit records or whatever. So we have laws that are about particular things, children's information. Europe has a broader set of rules. Right now, they're operating under the GDPR. And that basically sets rules or tries to set rules for all personal data defined in a particular way. So it doesn't really matter if it's social media data or videos or medical records or whatever, try to take like a singular approach. It's hard for us to do that in the United States because we have this countervailing free speech distribution of information thing. Mm. And Europe has run up against this. Today, there were two new opinions from European courts interpreting the clash between privacy rights and the right to disseminate information. But, you know, these are just two very different approaches. I think the United States generally tends to be more privacy protective with regards to government access than other countries do.
Do you mean by that? What's an example of that?
So we have in the United States a warrant requirement, which means that a judge from an independent branch of government looks at the police, the executive branch's determination about whether surveillance or searches, seizures is warranted, is justified, right? And makes this independent justification. Even in the UK, that decision is made within law enforcement.
Okay.
So they don't have like an independent.
So we have a more stringent standard by which people can search in theory.
We're more stringent. Right. Yeah. Right. And we have, and you know, if you look at other countries, you know, certainly outside of Europe, but we have this more stringent standard. Okay. It makes sense with our history that we, you know, have this approach. The Fourth Amendment was the founding fathers' response to abuses by the British Crown. So it makes sense that we just have a more privacy protective regime there. But our regime with regards to private or commercial collection of data is less stringent and comprehensive than that in other countries,
right,
like in the European countries.
And that's probably due to a more sort of like free market capitalist, less regulated approach to economics in the United States than in Europe,
yeah,
right?
I think that's totally right. It's cultural, it's economic, it's historical, it has to do with clashes with other laws. Uh-huh. Yeah, totally.
So, I mean, you must think about this a lot. How do you think these two sort of like opposing ideas can be reconciled around speech and privacy?
I mean,
I know it's a big question.
Yeah, just, no, whole life.
Even,
you know?
How do you even think about it? Like, because I'm sure you watch Black Mirror and all these shows that show us about how we're all doomed and everything, and you must have some, you've thought about a lot of these things. Like, how do we get to a place?
Well, we're all doomed. you know, like I said, I think in, you know, the vast majority of circumstances, privacy enables speech. But in these, there are these difficult points where we do struggle. And, you know, to some extent, I think we've thought about basically decentralizing so that people can protect themselves. So giving people the individual tools to protect themselves from unwanted data collection. And then also looking at platform regulation that's not about speech or user content on Facebook or whatever, but about databases and the way that like back end data brokers or advertisers process our data, which is a business interest, but, you know, not from the ACLU's perspective, you know, with that aggregation is not like the same kind of speech issue.
Right.
Yeah.
So that would sort of be like saying individuals have some control over, I'm going to say right to their own data, which I don't know if is correct. But
yeah, no, I think that's right.
So that it's like I actually own all this data and I get to decide who gets to use it. And I could charge people for it or they could give me services for it. But there's just once I use something, it doesn't mean that the information about me can just go anywhere.
This was an issue, you know, in the Supreme Court recently. One of the justices was talking about exactly this idea that just because your data isn't a secret from everybody doesn't mean that it doesn't still carry some kind of privacy or that you don't still have some kind of ownership about it. I mean, one thing we found in the privacy world is that the concept of ownership of your data isn't really it doesn't really address the problems fully because people will trade their private data for services,
you know, all the time.
Yeah, and we don't necessarily understand what the ramifications are. And when we do understand, you know, we know that this company is going to sell it or redistribute it, we kind of don't care that much in the moment. We don't have a sense of what the aggregation, you know, of all that data means. And then it's like, what data can I control? So, you know, with Facebook and the Cambridge Analytica scandal, you know, one of the big issues there was that it was users like me who, let's say, I can see your data, right, because we're friends on Facebook, I then let Cambridge Analytica siphon data out of my account, which include your information that you showed to me. So, you know, you have this problem where people are making privacy decisions about data that is jointly owned as well. And so, you know, this is why, you know, we're looking at consumer privacy laws to try to, you know, put some safeguards around this. It's hard. You know, it's not an easy question, but most of our issues in this area.
Yeah.
If they were easy, we would have solved them all already.
Right. So is that largely a legislative process or
yeah,
a challenge?
That aspect of it is. In California, we just passed some consumer privacy legislation that'll go into effect soon. I think at the federal level, Congress is considering consumer privacy legislation and the ACLU's lobbyists have been involved in, you know, in that effort. So it's definitely gonna be a regulatory advocacy issue.
Do you think that like pile on Congress here because I know it's a popular thing to do. But forgetting the individual members, like, do you think our system is actually set up in a way to handle these problems, to handle these issues, you know?
You know,
because it's so, it is really, really complicated. And of course, you watch, like, for regular Americans, they probably watch, like, you know, some people watch, like, Mark Zuckerberg before Congress, and you see these, then you have knowledgeable technology Americans, or however I would say that, who watch the same thing and think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's staff behind them who know what they're doing and research and the ACLU and lots of organizations that come and help and support and so forth. But but it's still sometimes it just seems like it's so complicated and so vast that like, are these, you know, 50 or 100 people really like capable of?
Yeah. I mean, the technology can be complicated. The international implications, you know, are complicated. You've got capture, you know, where powerful entities have the ear of lawmakers more than
non-powerful ones.
Yeah, more than consumer rights groups or civil liberties groups. And then you've got like real trade-offs that are hard decisions for people to make. And the public can be a little bit fickle because, you know, for a lot of people, they have lives and, you know, no insult to the American public at all. It's like people have lives, they have jobs, they have their friends. And, you know, they may be up in arms about something, but not realize yet that there's a downside, you know, and how do you figure it out? So then it's, you know, it's up to Congress. And it may be, this is why Congress hasn't
done anything.
Right. Maybe in some times that's a feature as opposed to a bug that Congress is delayed. But yeah, I think these problems are super hard.
I mean, that's by design, you would say, some would
to
say,
To some extent. But there are often times when you're just sitting there thinking like, why isn't anybody doing anything, you know, about this, about this problem? I mean, in the government surveillance context, it makes sense because national security interests and law enforcement interests are very persuasive to lawmakers. You know, nobody really got in trouble for catching too many criminals and, you know, having a few innocent people get sucked in. But if, you know, a guilty person goes free, there's a lot of blame, you know, that, that can be imposed for that. So it's just a very messed up incentive structure. And I think to some extent, that's probably true also on the commercial side, where you have these major businesses, data brokers and stuff, that can be very influential in terms of, you know, sort of structuring the public debate.
Yeah. So it hasn't been as much of a topic of conversation of late, but I think a few years ago, and certainly it's been something that people talk a lot about, and I know you've written about, is just overall, just talking about commercial and the intersection between commercial data and law enforcement, is companies giving access to their data and consumer information to the government, right? And some of this is, I think some of it is via warrant, which you can tell me. And some of it is stuff like the San Bernardino case, when they wanted Apple to give them like sort of like the backdoor code to the iPhone, so to speak. Where are we with some of those issues today?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, so, you know, we've generated all of this new information, right? And so one level of question is, what do the police need to show in order to be able to get access to that information? And then I think a kind of another important piece of that is, what are we as citizens allowed to do to try to take some of that information back and protect it? So, which, well, I want to talk about that in a second with the Apple versus FBI thing. But in 1986, the Congress passed a law, and that is the law, the main law that protects the privacy of our online communications and associated data. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA. And, you know, it's based on this old-fashioned 1980s. Think about what you were listening to, you know, and wearing back in 1986. It's based on this old-fashioned idea of how computers worked and what was sensitive. And it sets up this structure whereby content, so what we say to each other, is, you know, most protected. And then there are associated things like what time we talked, how much we talked, maybe, you know, email addresses.
So-called metadata.
Yeah, all the metadata. Exactly, all the metadata. And that receives this lesser level of protection. And the statute's complicated. You know, there's no need to really go into it. But I think the main thing is that it's pretty outdated. But that's what we rely on. I mean, between that and the Fourth Amendment, that's what we got. So.
Yeah, my computer history is pretty good. 1986, we're dealing with mostly, at least on the personal computer level, we're dealing with computers where you put in two floppy drives. Floppy, literally, like these floppy disks that were like 6 inches wide.
Yeah.
And you would have to use one of them just to start like Microsoft Word and the other one to...
Yeah, I mean,
this is
for
really,
whatever data you have.
This is really like, yeah.
Yeah. You know, the question is, do you still have any of those disks lying around with valuable information on it that you have no way of like accessing anymore?
Right. I definitely have them, but I don't think it's valuable information. But yeah, so it's a long time ago.
Yeah, it's a lot. Exactly. It's a long time ago. And so, you know, with all kinds of new data, we've been fighting this idea like, do you need a warrant for it? And the government's been pretty adamant that there's very few things that they actually need to go and get a warrant for.
Right.
You know, as I mentioned before, a warrant protects data by having a neutral and detached magistrate ensure that there's probable cause, good reason to believe that there's going to be evidence of a crime. It's not a fishing expedition or anything like that. And, you know, the Department of Justice has argued they don't need a warrant for our email, for our location data, for, you know, who we talk to, for our library records, for
and the
any
idea
of
there,
search
from their
histories.
their perspective is just that, like, we don't really have a reasonable
expectation of privacy
because, like, everybody reads people's emails and it's all over the place.
Emails like a postcard and the companies can scan it for advertising and spam and malware. So you've already given up whatever privacy you had there. And, you know, your physical location, you've given this data to the phone company, or you're walking around in public and people don't have privacy in public, you know, and who you talk to is just not that secret. It's, you know, there's cases from the 70s that talk about phone numbers you dial, and those weren't secret. So that kind of thing. And, you know, that's been one big battle area for us at the ACLU, which is trying to obtain a warrant requirement for more kinds of information. And, you know, the Supreme Court has been receptive to that argument that digital data is different and that we need to rethink our traditional privacy protections to be more expansive given the sensitivity of this kind of data. The next question is, okay, given that we're just proliferating this data everywhere, and it didn't used to be like this. I mean, like 15 years ago, it was entirely different. Before the smartphone, right, or, you know, social media or whatever, it was entirely different, smart cities. So are we allowed to, like, take that information back? You know, and technology took it away, our privacy. Can technology take it back? And to me, that's what battles like Apple versus FBI are like. Companies realize that people want more privacy, and they're building tools to give us that privacy. Is that allowed? Or are governments allowed to come in and basically say, we like the status quo as it stands now. The pendulum can't swing back and give you the kinds of protections, you know, the practical default world protections that you've enjoyed for the past 100 whatever years. You know, you're going to have to make sure that technology never protects your privacy from the government any better than it currently does. And these technologies are global. So that is a question that, you know, we have to answer, not just for Americans with regards to American law enforcement and American government agents, but for people all around the world.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things I was thinking about this was, and this comes up a lot, is also as a lot of this technology is made by companies in foreign countries that don't have the same standards. And so, you know, Apple or some other American technology company can do, like, all these great things to protect privacy and make sure their devices don't have a backdoor code and all these kind of things. But other countries might not have the same laws, and other companies can make things with backdoor codes for other countries, and then we could buy those, and then the U.S. government's like, well, they have the backdoor code, why don't we have it?
Right. I mean, China has, you know, it's a huge market, and so the government there has done, you know, a great job basically of encouraging these homegrown companies, you know, like Tencent or these homegrown social networks and everything, but they operate under Chinese law, which means they have to be able to give data over or do whatever. And American companies have, you know, made the decision about whether to operate in China or not, knowing what the demands of the government are. But, you know, as these companies get larger, they have shareholders, you know, that they are responsible to. And, you know, they don't want to forego business in India or Brazil or these other countries. And those governments make demands as well. So, you know, you can try to escape, but at this point, it seems like a lot of these companies are too far on in their, you know, sort of size to really basically say no to the governments of major markets like that.
Right.
So you do have this global effect. And then another thing that happens is, you know, you have governments that make rules that will affect American companies or, you know, companies that are selling to people all over the world. And it's like, well, when Australia passes a law that says something like companies will have to be able to provide plain text and can't use end-to-end encryption, they need to, you know, have the keys or have it architected so that our law enforcement can get access.
Then they have to what make two versions.
Yeah, or they either have to make two versions or eight versions or whatever, or they make one version and the laws in Australia impact our privacy and our security here.
Right.
That seems to be what's happening. It's hard for security, privacy, civil liberties advocates to fight these propositions, these proposals in every country around the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do our best.
Right. So does, I mean, on some level, does that just like raise the charter or the mission of ACLU to not just be about the United States, but be fighting for these things in other places? Because ultimately everything is so connected these days that, like, even if you won every single thing here, but it was different elsewhere, it would sort of end up affecting the civil liberties of Americans?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the A is for, in ACLU is for American.
Yeah.
But we know we have to work with other organizations. We're not an international organization, but we're allies with civil liberties organizations in a number of different countries, as well as international organizations like Privacy International or Human Rights Watch or that sort of thing. So we, you know, we have our colleagues who are, you know, focused on the international scene, and we try to, you know, coordinate work together, help each other out, that kind of thing.
Hmm. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So one thing I want to ask you about, people are really use these things, services a lot, and people are really exciting, are these services that sort of like map your genome, right?
Oh, yeah.
And regular people out there who don't think too much about these issues, and not to give them a hard time, because on some level, like, the history of the internet has been just like a whole bunch of people at every single second of the day deciding to not care about their privacy in order to like get better Google Map directions.
Oh, whatever, yeah.
Right? I mean, that's like essentially what makes the world go round.
When people say they don't like the internet, I'm like, okay, just give me your phone, no more Google Maps. And they're like, no, I need that.
Yeah. And every single thing we do, there's always a sharing of something personal. It seems innocuous, but when like connected with everything else, can be kind of scary.
Right.
So not to fault them, but what do you think about, like, how much should we be concerned about mapping our genome and having companies have that information, or forgetting even the liability of the companies having it, just of it like existing?
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is one of the fascinating things about today, is that there are things that we would never have allowed the government to do, right? Like,
right.
Collect all our location information, or, you know, put cameras up all over our neighborhood, or, you know, create a database of people's genetic material. But private entities, you know, providing these services have been able to replicate that function. And there's, you know, inadequate laws that prevent the government from taking advantage of that. We clearly, I think, need more in the way of rules to protect genetic privacy, because if we can't stop the database from being created, then, you know, we need to have the protections on the disclosure and use side.
Yeah.
But it's a real question in terms of what is the adequate protections, because this genetic information can be used in all kinds of novel ways, you know, from identifying predisposition for different diseases to where in the world your people come from.
Which you could see 2 years ago, I wouldn't have said I could see a scary future like this, but now you could see a scary future where we go from trying to stop people who don't live here from coming here to trying to find all the people who didn't live here after a certain date or something. Right,
exactly. Or to say, okay, we have this person who didn't have the proper documentation. They probably have family members here who also don't have documentation or harbored them or something like that. Let's find their family members. Or, you know, in World War II, Japanese Americans were interned, right? It's like, if you wanted to find all of the Latino people or everybody who comes from the Middle East, you can use a database like this to help you do it. You know, the thing that's been really interesting that they've been used for is this familial DNA searches. So where you have a sample of DNA, like from a crime scene, you don't know who the perpetrator is, and you submit it to, police have submitted to these databases and found family members. So this was the Trailside Killer case. And they found second cousins or whatever and did some investigation and then were able to identify the suspect, right? Which is amazing. I think the question that's so interesting there, it's creepy, it's amazing, but I think the question that's so interesting there is, whose privacy was violated, right? I mean, is the second cousin's privacy violated? They're sharing their genome purportedly, you know, to get information. Is the suspected murderer's DNA, left his DNA at the scene, you know, and so it's like, and then is a warrant make us satisfied there that, you know, everything was properly done? So I think it's very complicated.
In that case, it's like, it doesn't seem that bad because the guy was like a killer and they caught a killer, kind of what you're saying earlier. Nobody gets in trouble for arresting too many people.
Right.
But the same kind of thing.
He was a serial killer.
Yeah. But the same kind of thing could be, you know, around pre-existing conditions and like, you know, sort of what you were saying about the Facebook thing and Cambridge Analytica, which is that like, if I got my genome mapped or tested or whatever the proper word is there, sort of like on some level, I've also done that to my children, or like not all of it, but a lot of it.
Yes.
So I kind of like, you know, and so maybe they down the road in 50 years from now don't have access to some insurance or some type of thing because they don't even have their data, but they have mine.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's basically you're building this kind of Orwellian structure, and then you're just relying on rules to protect it from abuse. And that's a pretty uncomfortable position to be in.
Yeah.
You know, in the Japanese internment situation, information was collected for one purpose, and then it was, you know, in wartime, the purpose was subverted for the internment. And it's like, who's to say, you know, we can't, that sort of abuse won't happen again. But I should come clean and say that I have done the genetic testing, and I've found relatives through that process. And so, you know, these, from my choice to submit my DNA, I know you're thinking, like, what kind of privacy lawyer
I feel slightly reassured about maybe I should try doing it if you're willing to do it.
I mean, you got to be ready because, you know, I found a number of relatives, and that affected my family members' lives because, you know, they're suddenly these unknown, you know, relatives that they had never met before. And it wasn't my decision, you know, whether my, you know, family was going to have to, you know, reconcile.
You'd like kind of link to the chain.
Exactly.
And there's all these stories about people who didn't know who their parents, like they thought the parents were the wrong people and all these things, which are really scary. And
a
lot of implications.
Yeah.
So you thought a lot about this stuff. What do you think people should do? Like, tell me about your own guards of privacy, right? Are you, like, using Signal and, like, doing end-to-end encryption on all your texts?
Yeah.
Are you sort of more of the school? Yes, you are.
Yeah, I mean,
Separate how much of that is because you work at the ACLU and you feel like you should probably be slightly more careful, and how much of it is because you know what's going on and here are the productions regular people
should have. Yeah, that's totally the question, I think. Like, if you're a journalist or a activist or an immigrant or Muslim, or, you know, you may want to take extra steps to protect your privacy because you're in a vulnerable and targeted community.
Right.
And there are a lot of resources out there for people about how to kind of lock down things if your threat model is the government, right? But there are a lot of different threats out there. And I think for most people, a big threat is angry ex-spouses, hackers and identity thieves, maybe employers, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some basic things that people can do, not that hard, to protect their information from being leaked or inappropriately accessed. And just some basics, like multi-factor authentication. So, you know, I can explain what that is, but basically it's a way to make sure that your accounts are safe, even if somebody guesses or, you know, gets access to your password.
Yeah.
Password managers. So that's, for me, is like my favorite security tool. It enables you to have unique, difficult to guess passwords for every site.
Right.
Super valuable.
And you don't have to remember the unique, difficult to
I don't know
passwords.
Any of my passwords, except my password to that thing.
Right.
So that vault, that's the only thing, you know, that I know. Knowing how to use a VPN. VPNs don't hide your IP address from everybody, but you have to decide who do you want to see it, you know?
Right.
So you get a reputable VPN provider, and, you know, whenever you're on the Starbucks Wi-Fi or like the San Francisco Municipal Wi-Fi, use the VPN.
Right.
So just some base to protect your traffic. Look for ensuring that your website connections are HTTPS, you know, so that you can't be man in the middle. And also just being careful about what attachments you open. There's not too much stuff you can do about that. I mean, if somebody really wants to trick you, but don't fall for the easy ones.
Yeah.
You know, I think having some sense of, you know, what's a real, you know, what's a real email from your bank and what's not, and just being able to make a educated guess, knowing that you're, you know, not everybody's going to get it right all the time.
That seems like it's generally gotten better, that people have gotten smarter to it. And
yeah.
email platform companies have sort of gotten better at stopping that stuff from getting to you.
Yeah, absolutely. But for more at-risk communities, I think you do have to look to end-to-end encrypted services. I use Signal. Mm-hmm. I've started to use WhatsApp. WhatsApp's super popular around the world, so a lot of people use it, which is great. And thinking about using encrypted text instead of email for sensitive communications. You know, if you need to encrypt and you don't have to use email, you don't have to use email. And then, you know, just like encrypting your hard drives, you know, in case your laptop gets stolen or those sorts of things. But there are a lot of organizations that do training for journalists and activists about how to, you know, basically harden down your hardware and your accounts and make sure that they're protected. But I love the internet, so I don't think it's an option to be like, don't participate in social media, but just, you know.
And so what about protection from the platforms?
Yeah.
What about that? Because you sort of describe protection, like, I would say, from government surveillance and from, like, criminals, right?
Yeah.
But what about, like, protection from commercial entities?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, and for some entities, you're not going to be able to help it. Like, when you're on Facebook and you're making posts, you don't have a lot of choice about protecting your stuff from Facebook.
Yeah.
You can make choices about who on the platform sees your stuff to some extent, but you're not going to be able to really do that. But I think, and you know, for Google location services, if you want the map to tell you where you are, they're going to know where you are. But you can do things like, you know, Google lets you go back and edit or delete your information, so you can delete that periodically. You can have things on your browser that protect you against cookies or other kinds of web trackers, and I think that's useful. There are a ton of apps that are like free games or take a picture of your face and see what you look like when you're old or that kind of thing. And those apps often take very broad permissions to use your data, or they're lying to you about what they get. And, you know, you doing a review of those before you download them and just being really careful. I was looking yesterday. Actually, Google, my phone, warned me. Here, these apps have access to your location data. And you can choose all the time, only when the app is in use or never. You know, and I went through and I was surprised. Like, Outlook was using my location data. I don't
There's a lot of them try to all the time.
Yeah, I don't think Outlook needs to know where I am. Yeah. So, you know, just basically being careful about those permissions and, you know, knowing when and how to shut them off. It's an education thing. Like, with my daughters, they're 11 now, and, you know, they'd love to just download whatever games, but I try to show them, like, if they're not being charged for it, they're making their money somehow, and you need to look at the permissions, and is this a legitimate-looking company, and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot for an 11-year-old.
It is. It's a lot. The sort of digital citizenship is something we have to grow into.
What about, like, the newer Internet of Things that are everywhere?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, the really obvious thing is, like, the voice stuff, because that's the thing that even though you rationally understand that you've put a speaker and microphone inside of your home or bedroom, it's so easy to forget that there's a microphone in your bedroom.
Yeah. I mean, I've made a lot of apologies for people who, like, use social media or email or whatever. I just think you should not have those devices in your house, you know. And it's for two reasons. One is, you know, I mean, there's been all this news, right, about how it's not the trigger word. And then, you know, for, like, quality control, actual humans are listening to some of the conversations. And they're, like, storing them longer than they're supposed to store them because not really a, you know, communication or whatever. It's just, it's, you know, just in terms of the privacy from the companies, it's incredibly invasive.
Yeah.
But my concern is that what happens when the government comes and says, we want you to turn that speaker on and not tell the people so that we can listen to what's going on in their house.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically what we're doing is we are creating this distributed surveillance network that we just have to wait for the companies to get a demand from the government that they have to turn it on. Like, why would we put ourselves, you know, at risk like that just to be able to not have to write down on a pad, like, I need to get eggs at the store.
And so, most of these companies, at least today, are mostly sort of helmed by, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but more mildly progressive leadership. Maybe lots of people would say that they weren't, but they're certainly not known as, you know, the companies we're talking about, they're not known as being, you know, hardcore right-wing companies today.
Right.
In the future.
Right.
But even all these concerns and all this stuff with, you know, with leadership in those companies that generally would probably agree with ACLU or say they do, whether they do or not.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's totally right. I, in the beginning, there were a lot of social-minded lawyers with U.S.-informed set of legal values and policy values that were the ones who were hired for these companies.
Yeah.
And I'm not afraid to be apologist for them. Like, many of them are my friends, you know, or students or whatever. And we were lucky. You know, we were lucky that we had thoughtful people who wanted to protect speech or who wanted to, you know, respond appropriately to government instead of curry favor and, you know, took a lot of time and thought into figuring out, you know, how they were going to do that. Like, yeah, mistakes were made, but overall, the goals of these policymakers and these lawyers inside these companies was very much in line with U.S.-based values, which, you know, I agree with in terms of, you know, having higher standards for surveillance and, you know, protecting free speech. You know, over time, you know, it's these companies have gotten bigger, they've hired business people, or, you know, they have to be responsive to governments and to consumers in other countries, you know, and it's like, it's evolved. And so they're dealing with stockholders and demands from all around the world. And it's, you know, things have definitely changed. But, you know, I'm sure that there are lots of lawyers in these companies who have already made it clear to law enforcement that if you wanted us to turn on one of these speakers, you would have to comply with the Wiretap Act and get the kind of warrant that requires. But I don't want that to be my safeguard.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, and you can listen in to my house. Like, that doesn't seem like a good trade to me. That's pretty, that, you know, just make it so easy that the government just has to, like, get somebody to turn on a switch. So
yeah.
I don't think there that the law is an adequate protection from the possibility of, you know, it used to be hard to wiretap people. Now, if you could wiretap 100,000 people and just by turning on the switches and, yeah, we got a warrant. But, I mean, that just is not a good – that's just not a good trade between individual rights and government power.
Yeah. What would be the protection there? You think we need, like, technology that, like, blurs the sound while we're talking unless it's, like, I mean, what's the...
I mean, okay, let's say that I lose this battle and people get these devices.
They're going to, I mean...
right?
I think the history of the internet shows that, like, you know, they're going to put them in there, right? It's like at every moment we trade convenience. I shouldn't say they, I do it too. We trade convenience. I think the Google Maps Waves thing is a great example.
Oh, yeah, no,
we
I'm
always
guilty.
Trade the immediate convenience for...
The
privacy
cool thing.
Value and
I mean, so, you know, assuming it's true, I mean, I'm not an engineer, right?
Yeah.
But the problem generally is with centralization, right? And that the data is collected and processed in one place, and it's a one-stop shop for government or for attackers, basically, to come and get the information. The way that these devices were supposed to work is that all the data processing after the wake word is done
is done
on the client and then only sent up to the server once there's actually a verified, like, this is a real request, and they're not working that way. I guess the main thing I would say is that what you need is a hardware thing that tells you that the speaker is on, right? Because Apple did this with the Apple laptop, right? It's like, if it's software defined, you know, the light goes on when they're listening. If it's software defined, you can shut it off.
Right.
If it's hardware defined, the light goes on, even if the government says, we don't want you to let the suspect know.
Right.
You know, so
like,
to some extent,
it doesn't, I don't have control,
like, I don't
over,
have
the
control
light
over that.
Here.
So to some extent, things like that, where it's really about, like, ensuring that there'll be notice so there can't have this secret network of distributed listening speakers in everybody's houses.
Yeah.
So I think a mixture of, you know, different kinds of engineering resources.
And the decentralization is really important.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I'm sure there's probably people listening to this podcast who are like, I got some ideas.
Right.
You know?
Great.
So, but I think that's really important because you're right. I mean, we are going to be inviting more of these things into our home. We're going to have smart houses and we're going to have driverless cars and we're going to have smart cities and sensors that tell our consumption of electricity and all that stuff. And all these things are going to be really revealing. And for most of them, we don't have a choice.
Right.
You know, and so we need, if that's the way it's going to be, then the law's really got to step up.
I think I speak hopefully on behalf of at least the team here at the Webby Awards and hopefully the larger Webby community. Very, very grateful for all the work the ACLU does, especially in these, like, ultra complicated times.
Thank you.
Jennifer Granick, thanks for joining us on the Webby podcast.
Thank you. It was great.
Thanks so much to Jennifer Granick for stopping by the studio and speaking to us about her work at the ACLU. Quick Webby note, don't forget, this Friday, October 25th, is our early entry deadline for the Webby Awards. If you like the Webby podcast and want to support it, take a couple of seconds and give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you really like it and want to go to the extra mile, leave us a review. For more information about the Webby Awards, visit WEBBYAwards.com, that's WebbyAwards.com, or on social platforms at The Webby Awards. As always, you can reach me on social at DMDLikes. Our producer is Terrence Brosnan. Our editorial lead is Jordana Jarrett. Music is Poddington Bear. Claire Graves is that big, large scoop you get in a pumpkin carving kit. I'm your host, David Michelle Davies, and this is The Webby Podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.